Welcome to the City Club of Eugene, September 6, 2019. Our program, Spotlight on Gerrymandering, Legislative Redistricting 2020 and Beyond. This is the first program of our 2019-2020 programming year. My name is Eric Richardson. I am the president of the City Club of Eugene. Thank you very much. Very happy that the City Club is here for another fall season as we get into this year and we welcome our students back and parents. I know it's time to get back at it, and all our educators, we welcome you back and hope that you will see the City Club of Eugene as an important community partner. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, who exist to provide high-quality, affordable health care services and to improve the health of our members and the community they serve. More information at www.kp.org. University of Oregon supports the City Club of Eugene, and since 1876, the UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond as our hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years. It is their mission to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. And our Sapphire sponsor for today is the AARP of Oregon. The AARP celebrates creating livable communities for all ages. Learn more at aarp.org/OR. Now with the rest of our program, I'd like to invite to the podium Sandra Bishop, who is today's coordinator, and she will introduce our speaker. Sandra.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's wonderful to see so many folks here today for our first program to start the fall. We are very fortunate today to have as our speaker Professor Paul Diller, who teaches law at the law school Willamette University in Salem. And he has a very unique perspective as a scholar and also a practitioner of local government law. He studied and written about local control issues and preemption issues, and especially attempts by the state and the federal to preempt local authority. He's written and spoken about those issues for over 15 years. One of the papers that he just told me he presented this paper in Eugene at the university in 2009 was titled Partly Fulfilled Promise of Home Rule in Oregon. We're in a home rule county. We think we have home rule. How far does it actually go? The thing that made me really happy that Paul Diller agreed to come to speak today on gerrymandering is he wrote as the main author, he wrote and submitted an amicus brief to the U.S. Supreme Court in actually September of 2017 in a case dealing with gerrymandering in Wisconsin. So we have one of the foremost experts, I think, in the United States with us today. He was lead counsel on that brief that was submitted on behalf of the International Municipal Lawyer Association, the National League of Cities, and the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and the International City-County Management Association, as well as several other local government law professors. He holds a degree from a law degree from University of Michigan, and I was pleased to note he was a Clarence Darrow Scholar at Michigan. And I'd just like to stress that he's not only a preeminent legal scholar, but he is out in the streets practicing this. He's taking active part in the community and in local issues, his home being in Wilsonville. So with no further ado, I'd like to introduce Mr. Paul Diller, Professor Diller.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the kind introduction and for the kind invitation. It's great to be here. And so, as the title demonstrates, I'm going to be talking about gerrymandering. But first, it helps to lay out some basic ground rules about districting and how that frames the what we might call the opportunities for gerrymandering. So these are basically the federal ground rules for districting as applied to Congress. As I'm sure you all know from middle school or high school civics, the Constitution gives the U.S. House of Representatives, the lower house, the People's House, seats based on population. The upper house, the Senate, of course, is based is equal to two senators per state, regardless of population. And so because of that, we need an actual enumeration of states' residents every 10 years through the process we call the Senate. Now, since 1929, so 90 years now, the number of representatives in the House has been capped at 435. It wasn't always 435. It used to be much lower. Some say it should be much higher, but it's 435. So that means in 2020, we'll take the new population of the USA minus D.C., Washington, D.C., of course. They don't get anybody in the U.S. House who votes, at least. And we'll put aside Puerto Rico, too, because they're considered a territory. But we take the population of the USA of the 50 states. We divide it by 435, and we get a number. In 2010, it was around 710,000. In 2020, it'll probably be 770,000 or so. And depending on how many people are in your state, that's how many representatives you get. So Oregon, which had about 3.5 million people back in 2010, got, as it had for years, five representatives. And the only thing the Constitution requires is that every state, as far as numbers, is every state get at least one. So even if you're under that threshold, which just a couple of states are, like Vermont, Wyoming, they actually get a boost by that requirement that every state have at least one. On their own, they wouldn't merit one because their populations are below that U.S. total population divided by 435 average. So that's just how we allocate the seats across the country. What about within the states? Okay, since 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that all of the seats, all of the districts within a state, so all of Oregon's five districts, have to be equipopulous. That used to not be the case. So the case that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1964 came out of Georgia. You had one district of 100,000 people, one of 350,000 people. Okay, you can imagine in Oregon, you know, a Portland district or a Multnomah County district with a million and then a more rural district with 500,000. That's been illegal since 1964. Many states had banned that earlier, had made it equal earlier. But so we know that every district has to have an equal population. Since 1967, all seats, all 435 seats must be single member districts. Okay, that means you can't elect five representatives for all of Oregon on a slate ticket, which is how it works in a lot of other countries. Okay, a lot of other countries have something like proportional representation. Okay, but in 1967, Congress banned that practice nationally for good reasons at the time. At the time, they were worried about racial discrimination. They were worried if, you know, Alabama elected eight congressmen, they would elect eight white people in 1967. So those were the motivating reasons for banning that practice in 1967. And that law is still in effect today. And in 1964, of course, the U.S. Congress passed the Voting Rights Act, which has been amended over time and tinkered with by the U.S. Supreme Court. Some would say neutered by the U.S. Supreme Court. I won't get into the details of that. But the Voting Rights Act also requires that you don't discriminate in drawing districts on the basis of race or ethnic heritage. And in some states, particularly states with high minority populations, usually African American or Latino, the state actually has to kind of make sure it draws a certain number of districts to represent those populations. So here's a map of Oregon's five districts, okay? And as many of you likely know, we are suspected to get an extra seat after the 2020 census, assuming all goes well. That would then take effect for the 2022 congressional elections. Of course, that also means another vote in the Electoral College, since the Electoral College is the number of representatives plus your two senators. So we'll go from having 7 electoral votes to 8 if this prediction bears out. So that'll make, you know, redistricting even more interesting than it normally is, because that's an extra little goodie to divide up. Now, it's probably a more fun process in Oregon in 2021 to redistrict than in, say, Michigan, Illinois, Ohio, or especially New York, which are projected to lose seats. That's where you see, you know, real heated battles for politicians trying to hold on to their jobs. Okay, but so it looks like we're getting a 6th in 2022. We can talk about that more later. Here's some ground rules for state legislatures. All right, so in Oregon, we have 60 in the state House, 30 in the state Senate. As of 1964, the same year the Supreme Court decided that all U.S. House districts have to be equal populace, they also decided that all state legislative districts of either house, upper house or lower house, have to abide by the notion of one person, one vote. They were a little less politically correct back then. They called it one man, one vote, originally, even though we were well past women's suffrage. But anyway, one person, one vote. As Chief Justice Earl Warren said in the decision, Reynolds versus Sims, legislators represent people, not trees or acres. Go tell that to the U.S. Senate, but, you know, we'll put that aside, which is something that, you know, Justice Harlan brought up in his dissent. He said, well, you know, this is kind of hypocritical. But since that date, every state legislative district around the country has to be equal populace. And so states end up doing the same thing that that we do for congressional seats. They redraw their districts every 10 years because people move around, people die. And so the maps that we have from, you know, 2010 for Oregon's House and Senate districts are going to change just because of population change. Some districts will change a lot. Some might change just a little, okay, depending on how much influx or outflux there's been of population. There's a little more wiggle room when it comes to drawing state legislative districts. The Supreme Court has said you can deviate from equal population up to 15%, about 10 to 15%, if you're trying to do something the court considers legitimate, like, say, respect local boundaries, county boundaries, city boundaries. We'll talk about whether that's a good idea in a little bit. But there's a little more wiggle room in drawing these districts than there is for U.S. House districts. The Voting Rights Act also applies. And then as of 1968, the U.S. Supreme Court said one person, one vote. By the way, it also applies to city councils, county commissions, school boards, almost every form of local government. There are a few, maybe a specialized irrigation district where you can let just the landowners vote. Those cases are few and far between. For the most part, local government. So Eugene, as I studied for today, has a ward system. Those wards have to be equal populace under one person, one vote, which is rooted in the 14th Amendment, by the way, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Okay, so those are the federal ground rules. Usually states have their own law on this issue that lays out some more detail. A lot of that state law is redundant of these federal rules. Some of it preceded the federal rules. Many states complied with one person, one vote before it became a federal constitutional principle in 1964. Okay, but a lot of states add some other ideas too, like contiguity. They want all districts to be contiguous. Not divide communities of interest. It's kind of a fuzzy phrase, but, you know, they at least implore their legislators to respect communities of interest. They want districts connected by transportation links, share media markets, and then there are different sorts of prohibitions on discrimination on racial or ethnic grounds that largely mirror the Voting Rights Act. Okay, not every state has those, but many do. So Oregon has its own laws, and of course, as you'd expect, and these are what they say. They require equal population, so the Supreme Court could overturn Reynolds versus Sims tomorrow, and under Oregon law, we'd still have to have equal population for our districts, okay? They need to be contiguous, utilize existing geographic or political boundaries. So that might mean not just city or county boundaries, but rivers, mountains, lakes, those sorts of things. Not divide communities of interest, there's that term again, whatever that means. I was at a conference in Salem about a year and a half ago with the late Secretary of State Dennis Richardson, and somebody in the audience said in one of the recent redistrictings, communities of interest was taken to mean, in one district, high school basketball leagues. Okay, you couldn't divide them. We had to keep those together for drawing districts. So it means all sorts of different things. And obviously that leaves a lot of wiggle room for the legislature when they get to the task of drawing districts. And notice under Oregon state law, there is a prohibition on favoring political parties, incumbent legislators, or other persons. Not every state has that prohibition. Okay, but Oregon does have it in state law. Okay. Now, as with any law, you often have regulations promulgated by an executive official that fill in the interstices of those laws. And so the Oregon Secretary of State's office has issued rules over the years that provide a little more flesh to the bones of those laws, and they give a little more detail to the notion of communities of interest and be connected by transportation links. So, for instance, the transportation requirement, they say road connections of at least a county road should be available within the district from one area of the district to another. Okay, but that doesn't apply to unpopulated areas of the district. So here's what our House districts look like in Oregon. We have 60 of them. Because they have to comply with one person, one vote, we need to zoom in to see the districts in Portland. We almost need to zoom in to see the districts in Eugene and maybe Salem, because those are areas with denser population. So a tiny little area in Portland will get you the number of people you need that takes, you know, the almost the entire southeast quarter of the state to get the same number of people. So that's all the principles, but who is applying the principles? Okay, in most states, including Oregon, it is the legislators who draw the districts. It's done through the standard legislative process. The year after the census, the state legislature will designate a committee, usually the redistricting committee, and they sit down and they take the first crack at drawing the districts. Okay, people from other countries are shocked by this. All right, people from England, Canada, okay, because in many other countries they have neutral, independent commissions or persons or professional staff who draw the districts. That's not how it works in most of the USA. That's not how it works in Oregon. I mean, there's professional staff who help the legislatures, but it's the politicians who sit down and do it. By the way, it's the state legislators who draw all the districts, even congressional. Okay, so congressmen don't draw their own districts. State legislators draw them for the congressman. That's why state legislative elections every 10 years, so you know, 2020, previously 2010, are extremely important to districting. Because if you get a trifecta, so to speak, where you have a House controlled by Democrats, a Senate controlled by Democrats, and a governor controlled by Democrats, or flip it around, by Republicans, a trifecta of one-party control, you have the possibility of one party ramming through a partisan districting plan. Okay. Not all states do it that way. More states are moving toward having an independent or bipartisan commission. There's a lot of devil in the details there, but having some kind of party removed from the legislature with authority to draw districts for Congress or state legislature or both. Okay, two prominent examples of that are California and Arizona. Both, by the way, had these kinds of systems adopted by initiative. Okay, usually these sorts of processes, these sorts of systems come out of the initiative process, not out of the legislature itself. A few examples where legislatures have said, we'll give away this power to, you know, an independent commission, sure. Usually it comes from the initiative process, which, by the way, we have here in Oregon, and we haven't used it yet in this respect. Okay, it would seem like we're kind of a ripe state for this, but hasn't happened yet. Some other states have a strong tradition or a good system or a well-established system, I should say, of having nonpartisan staff draw the districts. Iowa's been famous for that, where a nonpartisan staff draws the districts. And the legislature still votes on them, but it's an up or down vote. So it doesn't go through the committee process. There's maybe not as much of the kind of backroom deals that can be done. So this term gerrymandering, okay, what do we mean by that? It's a term that you hear an awful lot. There's no kind of universal definition of it, but it has a few potential meanings I think we could agree on for today's discussion at least. So it's, I think, mandatory to show this original, the picture of the original gerrymander. which came out of Massachusetts around 1811. Okay, poor Elbridge Gerry, his name was actually pronounced that way, has forever had his name attached to the gerrymander. Okay, he was the governor of Massachusetts at the time, and he signed a plan drawn by the legislature that made this particular Senate district that one Federalist newspaper thought looked like a salamander. Salamander with wings, apparently. They attached Elbridge Gerry's name to it, and it became the gerrymander. Okay, forevermore. So what does it mean? Well, sometimes people use gerrymander to describe just any funny-looking district. Okay? Does a funny-looking district alone mean that it's gerrymandered? I would argue that's a little simplistic, if by gerrymandering you mean something bad. Okay? Because sometimes there are good reasons for districts to look funny. Okay? For instance, here's just something I thought up as I was preparing this. Let's say we wanted to draw a district, a state legislative district, that let's just say the population happened to map onto Eugene, and it was the Eugene district. I know Eugene's too big for one state legislative district, but let's just imagine. Look how funny Eugene is already, okay, with all these little islands of annexation. So if you were to draw the Eugene district, it would look a little bit like a salamander or something weird. Okay, so the shape itself, I would argue, is a little simplistic for pointing out, you know, kind of a negative implication from the district. So that's one way we might use the term gerrymandering. There's two more common ways or ways that we probably would, more of us would associate with a negative practice. One is intentional partisan gerrymandering. Okay, one party using the system, using the districting process to favor itself. The other is incumbent protection. Okay, this was more common probably 20, 30 years ago, less common today. But there are examples throughout history of Republicans and Democrats basically agreeing, well, we won't fight you, you won't fight us, so we can all hold on to our jobs. Okay, you could see districts drawn for either of those two purposes. For the most part, when I talk about gerrymandering from here on out, I'll be talking about the intentional partisan variety, where one party is trying to achieve a particular goal of, you know, helping itself, essentially. But there are other potential meanings to it. So here's an example from the Washington Post of kind of how gerrymandering can work. So gerrymandering has gotten a lot more sophisticated these days. Why? Well, we have computer mapping that Elbridge Gerry and his compatriots never could have dreamed of. We have a lot more data about voters. I mean, you know, the political people who work in professional politics, they can figure out how you're going to vote based on where you shop, what you purchase, which Facebook sites you like, you know, what you tweet, okay, and they use all of that and they plug it into an algorithm or a computer program, and they can figure out ways to kind of divide things up, complying with the ground rules to benefit their party. Okay, so this is just a simple example of how you could draw a hypothetical set of people or communities that is 60% blue and 40% red to turn into three blue districts or two red districts. That would be proportional to people's underlying views. Okay, that would be something like proportional representation. You could draw it so that it's five blue districts and zero red. Okay, that's kind of like Massachusetts. All right, Massachusetts has 11 Democratic representatives in the US House, not one Republican. Is that gerrymandered? I don't know, a lot of Democrats in Massachusetts, but surely it's not 100%. Okay, Oregon's 4-1 in the US House. It's not a 4-1 Democratic state. Is that gerrymandered? I don't know, but it's not proportional. Okay, and then you can see how it is possible for a minority to entrench itself, a political minority to entrench itself. You can draw the districts so that the 40% red wins three districts and the 60% blue wins only two. Okay, you can't draw it, it's almost impossible to draw it that the minority wins them all. Okay, but you can entrench a political minority, and we have really compelling evidence that's happened in several states around the country, particularly since 2010. And I'll talk about that in a little more detail as time permits. So these are some of the seemingly obvious, again, going back to the funny-looking shape, some of the seemingly obvious gerrymandering examples post-2010. Okay, my favorite is the third one on the right, known as Goofy Kicking Donald Duck. That's Pennsylvania's 7th congressional district. Okay, It just so happens that, yeah, it turns out there's some pretty good evidence that was that this is part of a plan that was drawn to benefit Republicans. Okay, but like I said, not all funny shapes mean bad things. They might, okay, but they might not. Here's another map. This is Wisconsin's assembly districts, assembly being their lower house. Okay, really doesn't look that bad. When you look closely at it, I don't see any goofy kicking Donald Duck or praying mantis. But many political scientists, many lawyers, many advocates would say this was the most gerrymandered map after 2010. Because it's possible to comply with the requirements of equal population and using county or city boundaries and draw a map that favors one party. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about Wisconsin and the Supreme Court case. I submitted a brief in Gill versus Whitford and what that led to and what that didn't lead to and where we go from there. So Wisconsin I'll talk about just because it's a great example and it's the one that went to the Supreme Court and seemed to have the biggest chance of establishing some kind of precedent against gerrymandering at the Supreme Court. Wisconsin was a Republican trifecta after 2010, and there's good evidence, record evidence, that the legislators, in conjunction with Governor Scott Walker, intentionally drew up a plan to benefit the Republican Party. You have a lot of other states where this happened after 2010, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, some states where there's good evidence of this happening in the Democratic direction. Some say Maryland, some say Colorado or Nevada, some say Vermont or Rhode Island. Okay, I won't get into the details of the evidence. But the plaintiffs, a group of plaintiffs led by a political science professor from Madison, a college town there, challenged the map and said that it violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and it violated the First Amendment by discriminating against him and his views as a Democrat because the whole map was rigged to benefit the Republican Party. And he got a lot of really impressive folks on board as his lawyers and as part of his team and recruited some other plaintiffs. And they took this case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. In the process, the plaintiffs proposed a theory for how you can measure gerrymandering called the efficiency gap. Okay, it was proposed by a political scientist slash law professor Chicago, Nicholas Stephanopoulos, who's now actually moving on to Harvard. And the whole theory is, just to kind of distill it into layman's terms, so to speak, would be we're trying to measure how much a plan packs and cracks votes. Okay, the idea was we can show that under this plan, the Republican Party of Wisconsin has packed a lot of Democratic voters into districts in Milwaukee and Madison, that they win 90-10 and 80-20, and they crack the rest of the Democrats so that the Republicans can win those other seats 60-40, 55-45, safely enough, but not by so many that they're wasting too many votes. Okay, so it's a way of measuring wasted votes. And what the plaintiffs thought was this was finally the kind of objective standard the Supreme Court might latch onto to declare partisan gerrymandering unconstitutional. They thought they had Justice Kennedy's vote in his waning days, Justice Anthony Kennedy, who recently retired. Okay, turns out 5-4, the Supreme Court rejected that. I'll talk about that more in a minute. Here's some evidence of how effective the Republican plan was in Wisconsin. Okay, you can see Democrats win 51% of the cumulative vote. That's the total vote for all state assembly candidates, all right, in 2012, but they only win 39 of 99 seats. Okay, fast forward to 2018, Democrats win 53% of the cumulative vote, wave election, right? And they still have only 36 seats. Okay, despite winning 53% of the cumulative vote. All right, in the Supreme Court, I'll get to that in a minute. The Supreme Court rejected the claim, or they held that the plaintiffs lacked standing, sent the case back to the lower courts. Chief Justice Roberts, in a harbinger of a decision to come a year later, dismissed the efficiency gap as he called it, sociological gobbledygook. Okay, sociologists were very offended by that. So that was in his concurrence in that case. A year later, you switch out Justice Kennedy for Brett Kavanaugh, okay, and we get another case that comes to the Supreme Court out of two states, Maryland and North Carolina, Maryland challenging a Democratic plan, North Carolina challenging a Republican plan. And the Supreme Court holds 5-4 now with Justice Kavanaugh in the majority, that all claims of intentional partisan gerrymandering are non-justiciable under the U.S. Constitution. Okay, the U.S. Constitution does not protect you from partisan gerrymandering, no matter how extreme it is. Good opinions by the majority and the dissent. You know, Chief Justice Roberts says this is just not our realm. How do we know how much is too much? How do we know when to measure it? Okay, let's say somebody sued about the Wisconsin plan in 2012. Is that enough data? Do we have to wait till 2014, 2016, 2018? Surely intent isn't enough, is it? Because sometimes a legislator or a party might draw up a plan they think is going to benefit it, and it doesn't work. Okay, so those were his arguments. The dissent said, well, written by Justice Kagan, there really is no other way, because how can you go around the legislature if the legislature won't fix it? Now, she didn't say this, but she should have. And if you're in a state without the initiative, you really only can look to the courts. Okay, if you're in a state with the initiative, like Michigan, Ohio, Colorado, the people have a way of getting around the legislature. In Wisconsin, they don't. There's no direct democracy. So they're stuck with this unless and until they have a state constitutional convention to change the way they pick their legislature. Or there's a wave election that's, big enough to overcome this, what appears to be a built-in bias in the plan. Now, not a political scientist, just a law professor, but it's impossible to get into this area without delving into some of the political science. There's a couple of ways to think about how we convert votes to seats. We use, in our country, for the most part, a first-past-the-post, single-member district of electing representatives, all right? So every congressperson just represents one district, and whoever wins a majority or a plurality gets in there, okay? Lots of other countries use different systems. Lots of them use something like proportional representation, which would be the straight line in that curve, right? If you win, if your party wins 40% of the vote, you get 40% of the seats. 50%, you get 50%. That's obviously not the case in Wisconsin, right, where Democrats win 50% of the cumulative vote, and they only get 36 out of 99 seats. That's like a third, okay? So some people would like proportional representation. That would be very different. We wouldn't have districts. You would vote for a slate of people, okay? But it would line up more with what the overall population thought. It would be less candidate-based and more party-based. There's this other notion called partisan symmetry. Okay, and that's this curve you see running through the proportional representation line is called the seats votes curve. And the idea the plaintiffs tried to use in Gill versus Whitford was, that seats votes curve ought to be the same for both parties under any plan, or it should be similar for both parties. If the Democrats win 51% of the total vote, they should get the same percentage of seats the Republicans get when they win 51% of the total vote. Now, that's not obviously how it was working in Wisconsin. Now, Chief Justice Roberts, very hostile to this, he dismissed the plaintiffs as wanting proportional representation. That's not actually what they wanted. They wanted partisan symmetry, which is a slightly different concept, right? They want a map that doesn't have a built-in bias against Democrats, or Republicans. But he rejected that notion, okay? So as I mentioned, the Supreme Court, most recently, just a couple of months ago, for now, at least, has killed the notion of ever using the federal courts to challenge intentional partisan gerrymandering. Thank you. That doesn't mean for those who don't like the practice, and maybe some of you do, I don't know, but for those who don't like the practice, which most American voters don't, by the way, polls show voters on a bipartisan basis, they don't like intentional partisan gerrymandering. Okay, there is still some hope in many states. One door that's still open for reformers is state constitutional litigation. So, most Americans actually don't know that every state has its own constitution, but they do. All right, in Oregon, our constitution goes back to 1859. It's been amended several times, but we have a state constitution. Some state constitutions have clauses in there about free or equal elections that don't mirror exactly anything in the federal constitution. Federal Constitution actually doesn't speak much at all about elections or about even a right to vote. I mean, many members of the Supreme Court don't even think there's a federal right to vote. Okay, they think that right to vote is contingent upon the state granting it to you. That's a debate for a different day. But a lot of state constitutions go further. So there has been successful litigation in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, under state constitutions. Florida, the voters in 2010 or 12, I can't remember exactly when, they adopted a constitutional provision that said, thou shalt not use partisan motives in districting. How do you vindicate that? You go to the courts, and the Florida courts have gotten involved. Okay, so either using pre-existing state constitutional language or amending state constitutions to have that kind of language, there is the chance of using state constitutions to challenge gerrymandering. There is also, as I said, a movement that's been afoot for really decades now of creating these independent or bipartisan commissions through the initiative process. So California and Arizona and pretty soon Missouri and Utah and Colorado are going to have them, although in some of those states the legislatures are trying to weaken or kill them. Okay, but putting that aside, voters have enacted plans that will create some kind of system that tries to remove the politics from it. But talk about this during my remaining time. You have to decide what you care about because there will always be competing priorities in districting. Okay, what do we care most about? Do we care most about geographically cohesive districts that look nice, that track city and county boundaries? If we do, we might not get equal representation of parties. Okay, why not? Well, this is a great book I'll recommend to you. I don't know the guy, I don't get any plug for endorsing this, but it's a book I read just over the summer, Why Cities Lose by Jonathan Rodden, political scientist at Stanford, excellent book. His thesis is because left-leaning voters, defining left however you will, tend to congregate more or be more clustered in big cities, and this goes back, as he documents, to the Industrial Revolution and unionization and lots of other forces, they tend to get hurt more by a system of first-past-the-post single-member district. There's a built-in institutional bias in that system that favors parties that are focused more on rural areas and that often represent the right of the spectrum. Now, that isn't the case everywhere. It doesn't have to be the case. If you don't have political parties that are geographically divided, it wouldn't be the case. But in our country, our political parties are extremely geographically divided. Okay, look at the 2016 election. Donald Trump won rural areas, overwhelmingly. Not exclusively, but most of them overwhelmingly. 60-40. 65-35. Hillary Clinton won cities, New York City, 85-10. San Francisco, 90-10. Okay, and now that's just the presidential, but it filters down to how people vote for Congress and for state legislatures. And his argument is, this actually ends up hurting parties at the left. Maybe we're okay with that because maybe we think the benefits of single-member districts are so great that we're willing to live with that. Okay, but his argument is we'll always have some of that bias built in as long as we use that system. He actually favors proportional representation, which is his example he uses is New Zealand. They moved from single member districts to proportional representation, and he thinks that's a lot more fair. People feel like their voices are heard more, and he thinks it leads to the creation of more minor parties to get more views out there. Now, proportional representation does have kind of a bad reputation in some quarters because, it's led to some bad things in history, like Nazi Germany. They had a proportional representation system then. That's not to damn the whole thing based on that one incident, but, it does have some historical baggage. But he cites recent evidence from New Zealand saying, it'd be much better. But we would lose geographically cohesive districts. We in Oregon would vote for a slate of candidates, okay, for the whole state, based on party. All right, but it would be a lot more proportional. Okay, racial representation. Well, if we start doing at-large districts, in Alabama or Mississippi. Okay, how do we ensure that we'll still get, two or three or four or five African-American representatives? Okay, we might not. All right, so we'd have to tinker with the Voting Rights Act, which is obviously, politically perilous. But the point is that these goals are often in conflict with each other. All right, if you want competitive districts, so Arizona, when it adopted its reforms to create an independent commission to district. They said the number one priority here, aside from all the basic stuff like equal population, et cetera, is competitive districts. If you want competitive districts, you might have to actually make them really funny looking to get them competitive. How are you going to get a competitive district in Portland, in the middle of Portland? Draw a little circle in Portland. It'll be 80-20 Democratic. You want to make it competitive, you're going to have to draw a salamander going out to rural Oregon. All right? So one of the ironies of Rodden's book is he says, we might actually want to do more gerrymandering. We might want more funny-looking districts to get them more competitive. If that's what we want, maybe we don't want that. But the point is, there's a whole bunch of questions we have to decide as we think about districting reform that may be in conflict with each other. There really are no easy answers here, okay? But that's not to say that we shouldn't try. I mean, just getting the politics out of it, getting rid of the egregious cases, like, say, Wisconsin, okay? That's certainly moving the ball, you know, in a probably what most of us would consider a more lowercase d democratic direction, okay? And you have to be a little bit careful about this argument here, this, you know, urban areas are disadvantaged argument, because those who defend intentional gerrymandering in places like Wisconsin, and there are those who defend it all the way up to the Supreme Court, okay? Those who defend it with a straight face will say, no, we can't do anything about it. It's because all the Democrats, they all cluster in Madison and Milwaukee. It's their fault. Blame them. You know, it's just the way it is, okay? That's not really true. If you look at the data, you run the numbers, the Republican plan in Wisconsin exacerbated maybe a slight built-in advantage the Republicans had, maybe even a substantial advantage, but it exacerbated it. Okay, so if we remove the politics, we would still make some progress, but we might not solve all of these problems. Okay, we're still going to, as long as we have single-member districts, end up with a composition of the state legislature or a Congress that doesn't necessarily reflect what everybody's thinking in the entire state or the entire country. And maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a bad thing. Well, I'll leave it at that for now. I'm really looking forward to your questions. Thank you for your attention.
All right, thank you, Professor Diller. Now we'll take a break so you all can formulate your questions, and we'll be right back.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC, Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the September 6th, 2019 program, Spotlight on Gerrymandering, Legislative Redistricting 2020 and Beyond with Professor Diller. Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our sponsors. Our gold sponsors today are Arriving by Bike, Cato's Turnside and Balthrop P3, PC, Evans Elder, Brown, and Schubert Commercial Real Estate. And last but not least, Dr. Sandy Ibarra, Hearing Associates. And a special thanks to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM, 91.9 Radio, Dot Dotson Photography, Pack Info, and Simplified Computing, LLC. And now I'd like to bring Sandra Bishop up to help with our question and answer session.
All right, this is Sandra. Thanks so much. We're going to have the first question come from our president, Eric Richardson.
Thank you, Professor Diller. This is Eric Richardson with City Club of Eugene. Also, I just wanted to ask you, do you believe that the current Supreme Court's decision not to have a role in the gerrymandering issue makes them activist judges? Or do you feel like they acted in a partisan way themselves by not inserting themselves into that issue?
Thank you for the question. I would say that's a tricky question to answer because, well, first of all, Chief Justice Roberts would say they were decidedly acting in a non-activist way because they didn't step in to overturn the legislative process. And when that, I'll call it slur of activist judge first emerged in the 60s and 70s, it was used against judges who imposed as a constitutional rule something that overturned a product of the legislative process. And so that's what Chief Justice Roberts said in his decision was, this is not for us. We are not going to promulgate a new rule. This is for the legislative process. Now, I think if the slur activist has any kind of theoretical justification, it's that judges shouldn't be stepping in because legislators are democratically elected. Okay, that gets turned on its head with gerrymandering, in the sense that you could argue they're not democratically elected, the legislators. They've locked themselves in for life, and that's the argument Justice Kagan made in her dissent was, well, you know, we kind of have to step in here because nobody else can. And if you go back to Earl Warren and Reynolds versus Sims, which established one person, one vote in 1964, was derided as completely activist. And what Chief Justice Warren said years later was, well, we weren't being activists, we were just correcting the democratic process. Okay, so it sort of depends on what you mean by activism and, you know, what part of that slur appeals to you or doesn't appeal to you.
So before we, thank you, that was a good question, great answer. So before we go to the next question, I'm going to ask for a show of hands from the audience. How many of you, just so Paul can understand who's here, how many of you in the audience are former legislators? And how many others in the audience are current or previous elected officials? Thank you. So we've had it be very personal. So Scott.
Scott Coltrane, City Club member. I'd really like to hear from you what you think is going to happen after the census in Oregon. Given our legislature, are we going to get a sixth seat? How you think that's going to play out?
Thank you. I haven't spent too much time thinking about that, but I think everyone's very hopeful we will get a sixth seat. As of now, unless there is a constitutional amendment, that means that the process of districting will, as always, go to the legislature. It'll depend on kind of who controls the legislature after the 2020 state legislative elections. The Democrats have supermajorities in both houses. We'll have to see how the election shapes up in 2020. If they hold on to that, that would give them a very strong hand in districting, and would seem to give them the opportunity to create a map that favors Democratic congressional candidates. If Oregon has six seats and then you have five Democrats and one Republican, it starts to look a little gerrymandered. That doesn't mean it is gerrymandered, but it starts to look more gerrymandered. So, you know, there may be pressure to create more of a Republican seat or more of a competitive seat. I don't know. But, you know, there is talk of different initiatives being on the ballot in 2020 to create independent districting commissions. I don't know how much legs they have behind them, how feasible they are, but, you know, there's talk of that. But right now, it looks like it's just going back to the regular old legislative process.
Thank you. Yeah, we just have a short time for questions, so when you're finished asking the question, it'd be great if you'd move back to your seat. Let's go right ahead.
Professor Diller, thank you for coming. Becky Gladstone, City Club member. Also, my question comes on the basis of my position as president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'd like to tell you that the National League is committing $500,000 around the country to support redistricting reform. And here in Oregon, we're working towards a citizens initiative redistricting commission, an initiative for that. And we've been working on this for over a year with maybe a couple of dozen presentations around the state. If you could speak to how to make this more compelling to our voters, it can be soporific because it's dense. Thank you.
Thank you. Good question.
Thank you. Yes, I'm aware of the league's efforts, and those have been successful in other states. I know in Florida, which I mentioned earlier, has an anti-politics amendment in its constitution. The League of Women Voters was very involved. How to make this more appealing to voters? Well, you know, others have tried this. Michigan succeeded in passing an initiative. In fact, there's apparently a movie about it that I haven't seen yet called Slay the Dragon. But it's a documentary about how Michigan succeeded in this. And I think the key is just reminding people or making them realize that they may not have a voice. They think they have a voice by filling out their ballot, but kind of letting them understand that in a lot of ways they don't, because they live in an uncompetitive district, or the districts were drawn to kind of benefit one party or the other. So illuminating that and making people feel like they have something to gain or something to gain back at the ballot box.
Thank you. Next question.
Yeah, I'm Jack Tresser. I have, I guess, kind of a theoretical question, and it's a theoretical issue that I hope will move beyond theory in the near future. The problem is that approximately half of American voters don't identify as either Republicans or Democrats. And as long as they just remain splintered in a dozen different movements and parties, they have no power whatsoever. So I think in Uruguay is a wonderful example of how people got around that. They formed something called a broad front party. Argentina is moving in the same direction. I would propose a no more war party, which would draw from lots of different places. So how would this whole districting system work with this kind of a radical reformation of American politics?
Well, I think one of the reasons the two-party system is so entrenched is because we do use first-past-the-post single-member districts. Many of the other countries that use that tend to have a two- or maybe three-party system, like the UK has conservatives and Labour, with Liberal Democrats, Scottish National, but, you know, mostly conservative and Labour. When you look at other countries like, say, New Zealand, Israel, Germany, their smaller parties tend to have more of a voice, in part because they have proportional representation. Now, in most of those countries, you have to get over a certain threshold. If you get 1% of the votes, you don't get 1% of the seats. You have to clear a 3 or 4 or 5% threshold designed to eliminate the real fringe parties. But if you get 5%, you might get 5% of the seats. That'd be a very different system from what we have now.
John DeLoe, City Club member, and I have a question for one of the people at our table. Can you expand a little bit more on Kagan's dissent? And is that a good roadmap to battle gerrymandering per state?
Well, yeah, Justice Kagan, who dissented in Rucho and wanted the court to declare or at least recognize that intentional political gerrymandering could violate the Equal Protection Clause or the First Amendment, she did have the benefit, being in dissent, of not having to come up with a strict test. And that was, of course, the majority's criticism of going down this road is, well, what kind of test could we really draw up? So she didn't have to come up with a test. I think maybe another place to look besides Kagan's dissent would be the district court decision in Gill versus Whitford. They came up with a test. And I can't remember all of it, but it was essentially evidence of intentional partisan gerrymandering. So you need that smoking gun. You need, you know, the evidence that people were sitting in a room and trying to rig the districts to benefit one party, and good evidence that it's effective. Okay, because again, as Chief Justice Roberts said in Rucho, he said, you know, there are instances where parties think they're rigging the system and it actually backfires. Okay, so you need evidence that it's effective. How long do you wait for that? What kind of evidence? Well, you know, we need more detail on that. But if you do a commission, an independent commission, you don't have to sit around and wait and sue. You just have the commission taking part in the districting at the beginning.
Thank you.
Mike
Rose. We have
Rose.
Time for one more question. So Mike, go right
City
ahead.
Club member. Usually when we talk about gerrymandering, we jump to the party politics of it, trying to strengthen and make it more easy for one party to control than the others. However, there's another issue out there, and it has to do with the size of some of our districts. Look at Eastern Oregon and Malheur County. The size, the mass there. At the same time, we're living in a society where what one county does affects everybody in the state, environmentally particularly. So there are these wider issues. How do we address the problem of size and the control size itself gives, even though they don't have the numbers?
Well, I think what you're hitting on is a slightly different issue, which is how the state legislature interacts with counties. And yes, we do have some very large counties, but under Oregon's home rule system, if the state legislature wants to preempt them, they can. So if the rest of the state, the rest of the population of the state has a concern about a particular county doing something that has a negative effect on the rest of the state, the legislature can pass a law that would kind of strip that power away from from the county regarding most things, not all necessarily. But as far as just the size of the districts, I mean, you know, that was one of the objections Justice Harlan raised in his dissent in Reynolds versus Sims is, you know, well, there are all kinds of reasons why states draw districts of different population. And Chief Justice Earl Warren said, well, I don't care. Legislators represent people, not trees or acres. Okay, I've talked to people who disagree with that. They think legislators should represent acreage. Okay, and if that's not your view, then the sizes should be even or they should be more even. But if it's about people and equal population, then they're going to vary extremely widely.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry we've run out of time. I'm going to let Eric wrap it up, and thank you very much, Professor Dillon.
Well, this has been a very important and enlightening discussion. I'd like to thank you all for being here, and I'd also like to thank public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Mondays at 6:30 p.m. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County, cable channel 29, for televising recent City Club events. Next week, we have a program on the Mile High occupation, part one of a two-part series. We are taking our show on the road for the September 27th program. I'm going to ask our past president, Joel Corin, to come and give us a little information about these programs. Please welcome Joel.
I'm very excited about these programs, and I believe you will be too. I've met the speakers, and they're some of the most interesting people I've ever met. Next week, we're going to have Professor Peter Walker, who wrote this book, Sagebrush Collaboration, and it's a book you can get for free at the Ford Family Foundation. Go to their website. You can get it for free. It's a book about the occupation. We will also have Pauline Brayman, who is the editor of the local newspaper and a reporter for the Oregonian. We'll also have Sheriff Dave Ward and Judge Steve Grasty, who are two people who you saw on television every night during the course of the occupation, and by many are considered the heroes of keeping Harney County together. The second part of the and that program will be here at our usual time and place. The second program will be recorded out in Bend on the 27th and will feature four people involved with a High Desert Partnership that fostered the collaboration for years that led to the victory for collaboration over confrontation. They are Gary Marshall, who was one of the founders, who is also a rancher and president of their board, Chad Cargis, who was the director of the Malheur National Wildlife Reserve, Dan Nickel, who is a rancher and former county commissioner out there, and Brenda Smith, who is their executive director. We will have a program here in Eugene that'll show that on the screen, what's being recorded out there. So if you don't want to go to Bend, come here and we'll have it. There will be a way that we will announce where people here will be able to ask questions. Secondly, if you want to go to Bend, they are reserving seats for us if you make a reservation. See me, email me by Monday, because we have to get that in, then it'll be open up to the members of the Central Oregon City Club. So it's Joel Corin, J-O-E-L-K-O-R-A-N, at gmail.com, or see me today. Sandwiches are available for $10.
All right. Thank you, Joel. One more bit of information. We're asking you all to provide names of nominees who might be willing to, or who we think could be part of our annual program, the annual gifts to the city that will happen in December. So if you have any ideas for nominees for the annual gifts program, please bring those ideas to Joel once again. Joel does a lot of work for us. Thank you, Joel, once again. More details and information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, City Club of Eugene. Now let's thank our speaker, Professor Paul Diller, one more time. Thank you, Paul. This concludes today's program. Thank you and see you next week.